its current state. Thanks for joining us here on 90.5 WKAR and on WKAR.org. An interesting lineup of segments are planned today. It's National HIV Testing Day, and there's a social media-driven initiative in the area going on. That's an effort to motivate people to get tested. And then to kind of share the experience on social media, we'll talk about that coming up in the program. There's also a huge antique radio and TV expo planned for Lansing. We'll chat up one of the leading participants. Stevens T. Mason, the boy governor, is not going to be on the show, but we are going to devote a segment to him here later on today with someone who's written a book about the boy governor. At the top of the program, gay rights activists cheered two decisions yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. One overturns parts of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. The other effectively allows same-sex marriages in the state of California. Among other things, the DOMA ruling means many gay spouses will be able to receive Social Security benefits, will jointly file tax returns, and share health care plans without a tax penalty. Social conservatives decried the developments. Gary Glenn, one of our upcoming guests here, president of the Michigan chapter of the American Family Association, tweeted, "Marriage in Michigan will remain between one man and one woman." Now, the rulings could trigger other legal actions. Analysts point out that a great deal of law pertaining to gay marriage and related issues are still controlled by the states. Michigan is one of 38 states that forbid gay marriage. Here to respond to the rulings and share their thoughts on what they mean and what lay ahead is Emily Devendorf, Managing Director of the Group Equality Michigan. Hi, Emily.
Good morning.
And over the phone, Gary Glenn, head of the Michigan chapter of the American Family Association. Gary, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, Emily.
Well, first of all, Emily will come to you first. Your general response to the Supreme Court rulings yesterday. What's your takeaway?
We are thrilled with yesterday's rulings. We think that it's a great first step forward in terms of federal recognition of our relationships and that we should be seen as equal under the law. There's still much work to do, but yesterday was a good day, and I think we're still waking up feeling like this is a great start towards finally righting a whole lot of wrongs.
And Gary Glenn, your general response, please.
Well, as you had in the sound clip, we're thankful because it could have been worse. The United States Supreme Court could have issued an illegitimate decision by which they attempted to strike down all state marriage protection amendments and the votes of tens of millions of Americans who put those into their state constitutions. But certainly we're happy that Michigan's marriage protection amendment was untouched. And one big difference between Michigan and California is that if some federal judge here in Michigan presumes himself in the position to overturn the vote of millions of Michigan voters, including two-thirds of black voters and two-thirds of union households who polls said voted for the marriage protection amendment, we have an attorney general in Bill Schuette who will aggressively defend our marriage protection amendment, will appeal it to the Sixth Circuit and up to the United States Supreme Court. One thing Emily and I may agree on is there is a case in Oakland County which could very well be the vehicle by which the United States Supreme Court in a couple of years actually addresses the merits of whether or not Michigan and the other 30 states that have passed marriage amendments can do so.
Tell us about the case in Oakland County.
There's a case in Oakland County, two lesbian women who have sued for adoption of some children, but the judge invited them to make it a broader suit against the marriage protection amendment. He heard all the hearings. And then he said, I'm going to hold off and wait until the United States Supreme Court rules and take their direction. So he seems to be signaling that he is going to follow the example of the openly homosexual judge in California who one individual, you know, thought himself in a position of legal authority to strike down the vote of millions of voters. So if this judge in Oakland County does the same, it will be appealed by the Attorney General of Michigan to the Sixth Circuit. Whatever the result, no doubt it would be appealed to the United States Supreme Court. So in 2 to 3 years, we could have back before the court the same issue, this time with no question of standing, in which the court would actually be addressing the merits of Michigan's marriage protection amendment. And whether or not, you know, going a debate going back as far as President Thomas Jefferson and President Abraham Lincoln, whether or not five lawyers who wear black robes have the constitutional authority to dictate to both houses of Congress, to the president, and to all 50 states.
All right. Let's get Emily in on this conversation. Viewing comments on social media yesterday, Emily, gay rights advocates are clearly energized. To what extent might yesterday's rulings accelerate support for overturning Michigan's gay marriage ban?
Yes, I think that regardless of what happened yesterday or what could have happened yesterday, the momentum is just going to continue to build. We are ready to achieve full equality under the law, and we love that lawyers in robes, we do call them judges, regardless of their sexual orientation. Lawyers in robes are our judges and our legislatures and our people. They're all realizing that we should be looking at the rights that we have denied LGBT citizens at this point in history, and perhaps trying to make sure that we are on the right side of history from here on out and respecting our Constitution, which should provide equal protection to all of our citizens. And that is not something that is going to move backwards. That is something that is only going to keep moving forward. So certainly whether we got bad news yesterday or even better news, there's enough work to be done still that we are just going to keep moving forward. And the base is really just building, and more people are coming to our side every day so that Gary's friends tend to be the outliers on this issue at this point.
Gary, will the ruling lead some number of your allies to re-examine their opposition? Could it change the minds of some number of Michigan people who have opposed it?
No, honestly, I don't think so. I think when the debate is engaged again, that more and more people will move in the direction that we hold, that marriage is between one man and one woman. It's what's best for children. It's what's best for society. I mean, for a lot of people, obviously, it's a matter of religious conviction. We're concerned about the religious freedom and rights of conscience. You've had Christian photographers and bakers and caterers and bed and breakfast owners and florists across the country who have been fined thousands of dollars and sued because, as a matter of religious conscience, they refused to service a homosexual wedding. You had one church in New Jersey that lost its state tax exemption because it wouldn't allow its chapel to be used for a homosexual wedding. In addition to that, it's going to have practical financial implications. The Wall Street Journal.
Do you feel that you're being persecuted by the decision?
Well, no, but I'm not a Christian florist like the grandmother out in Washington right now who's just been fined $2,000. Because she wouldn't provide flowers for one of her customers who wanted to have her service his homosexual wedding, or the Christian photographer in New Mexico who was fined $6,000 because she wouldn't photograph a homosexual wedding. In addition to that, I do feel as a taxpayer, I'm among the millions of American taxpayers are going to have to pay the additional billions of dollars in increased federal spending to provide all federal benefits to the new category of beneficiary that's been created by the court's decision yesterday. That is, you know, in homosexual relationships, not only all federal government employees, we have a $17 trillion debt, and yet we have now an expanded benefits package for federal government employees.
Okay.
So it has practical implications as well as religious freedom and rights of conscience issues.
Emily, care to respond?
Absolutely. So the first thing I want to address is that Michigan citizens have already shifted on this issue. When we vote on this in 2016, there is just no way that it's going to have more support than in 2004 because the level of support has almost completely shifted since 2004. In 2004, when we voted to ban same-sex relationships or legal recognition of same-sex relationships, the support from the public was 59% for that ban. And today, Michiganders poll in favor of repealing the ban and replacing it with full equality under the law for Michigan LGBT citizens at 56% to 57%.
Gary Glenn, I mean, the attitudes toward this appear to have changed really dramatically since 2004. How do you factor that in? I mean, you place a lot of importance on the 2004 incident, but clearly, I mean, just in the last couple of years, attitudes appear to have changed dramatically.
We found that historically on polls on this issue that support for so-called homosexual marriage rises when it's not at issue, but when it actually comes to a vote, it reverts back to what people's, you know, actions are going to be in the privacy of a voting booth. There was a poll done by Gallup that said that 51% of Michigan voters would oppose the Marriage Protection Amendment and only 45% would vote in favor of it. The catch is that came out 6 weeks before the November 2004 election, and 6 weeks later, Michigan voters voted nearly 60% in favor of the Marriage Protection Amendment. A Democratic campaign consultant in Lansing, you guys probably know him, Mark Grebner, did a poll about 3 years ago in which he found that 90% of Republicans and 60% of independents and 49% of Democrats in Michigan said they would vote no on any future ballot measure to attempt to repeal our Marriage Protection Amendment. And just, again, as a practical political consideration, Mark and Emily, you guys have been around the block. I mean, any proposed ballot measure that isn't polling in the mid-60s before the campaign even starts typically fails. So we're as confident as Emily claims to be of what the outcome will be if it's put on the ballot again. I think Emily and her allies are counting their chickens not just before they're hatched, but before they're even a twinkle in the rooster's eye.
Well, luckily, we are starting work now towards repealing the ban in 2016, and we're not concerned about it. You are correct. We're not concerned because just within the last year, while Republicans are not polling majority in favor of marriage equality, their support for marriage equality in Michigan has doubled in a year. And the support for equality across the board in second-parent adoption, in protections in hate crimes, in protections from discrimination and employment, housing, and public accommodations, those are all polling from 60 to 70%. In favor, in support from the average Michigan citizen. So the equality is now a Michigan value. The average Michigan citizen very much favors fundamental fairness, and they certainly do not see it as some issue that is in conflict with religion or with religious rights. In fact, even in the area of marriage equality, where it's often cited as something that is contentious and something to be concerned about by extremists like yourself. In fact, clergy members have always been able to legally deny offering same-sex marriages in their churches. It will be left up to our churches even after we pass marriage equality whether they want to perform marriage ceremonies between whomever is interested in getting married and committing their lives to each other in order to provide stability to their families. And that's what this is really about. This is about trying to provide stability to our families and be able to show our love and commitment to somebody that we have grown to care for and want to care for a lifetime.
We're talking with Emily Devendorf, Managing Director of the group Equality Michigan, and Gary Glenn, head of the Michigan chapter of the American Family Association, about their views on yesterday's Supreme Court rulings and related issues. Gary Glenn, this issue does involve rights to quite an extent, especially financial entitlements. In the case U.S. versus Windsor, the plaintiff would have had to pay $360,000 in taxes on her partner's estate. If her partner were a man who was her husband, she would have had to pay zero. How is that legally justified in your mind?
Well, I think it illustrates the point that equal access to the institution of marriage is not the objective of this political movement. It is to radically redefine marriage. Everybody knows what marriage is, a matter of common sense. It's been defined this way for thousands of years. And, you know, the question is, if you redefine marriage once to meet the demands of groups such as Emily's, then on what rational basis before a federal judge do you refuse future interest groups' demands that you radically redefine marriage further to meet and incorporate their lifestyles? You know, I think the truth of what this agenda is, and when the Michigan voters are reminded about this and whatever ballot campaign may ensue in the future, you know, there's a lesbian journalist in New York named Masha Gessen. And she said recently on a radio show, I can send you the link, you could actually play it to your listeners. She said it's a no-brainer that we should have the right to marry, but I also think it's a no-brainer the institution of marriage should not exist. Fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we are going to do in marriage when we get there, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change, and that is a lie, quote-unquote. University of Michigan law professor David Chambers said, quote, by ceasing to conceive of marriage as a partnership composed of one person of each sex, the state may become more receptive to marital units of three or more. So imagine what will be the cost to taxpayers when the next marriage equality campaign is launched for polygamy and group marriage. That's going to cost taxpayers a lot of money to provide these type of benefits, and
Okay.
Under our tax code.
You've stirred up an awful lot here. Let's give Emily a chance to respond.
Yes, I would say first, I don't really trust the convenient quoting, because yesterday Mr. Glenn quoted Martin Luther King in order to defend inequality. So I don't really pay much attention to those references, and I disagree with whomever he is quoting on this particular issue. Our relationships already exist. We already have families. We have children that we would like to provide for. There should be nobody that wants to get in the way of us wanting to commit ourselves to one other person for the rest of our lives in order to care for that person and to be able to provide stability for our families. That is essentially part of the family values platform that the right has been pushing for many, many years as their own, when in reality it is most of our, it is within most of our value systems to want to be able to care for the people that we love, and that is all that we're asking for. And unfortunately, the law is woven all the way through the institution of marriage. So until and unless we take the law out of the institution of marriage, marriage is the only way that we can have equal protection under the law and not be discriminated against and not be disabled in our ability to care for each other.
Emily, what's your plan? We're close to running out of time. How do you approach the next couple of years between now and November 2016, when the ballot, apparently your efforts will clearly be devoted to getting this on the ballot?
Absolutely. And we still have a number of other rights that we need to win to establish equality in Michigan, because in Michigan we have, of course, nothing for the LGBT community. But I have every month of the next 3+ years mapped out towards winning equality under the law through the repeal of that constitutional ban in 2016, and I intend to do that in order to ensure that we are able to love the people that we are lucky enough to fall in love with and create families with and our partner. And that is one of the most basic values that of the American society, and I think the Supreme Court yesterday established that we should all have the right to do that and to be able to do that equally.
This has been a stimulating discussion. We thank both of our guests here this morning. Gary Glenn is the president of the Michigan chapter of the American Family Association. Emily Devendorf is with the group Equality Michigan. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Time now for another Current State Public Poetry Announcement.
Asking About You by Louise Klein Healy. Instead of having sex all the time, I like to hold you and not get into some involved discussion of what life means. I want you to tell me something I don't know about you, something about the day before that photograph in which you're standing on your head. I want to know about softball and the team picture. Why are you so little next to the others? Were you younger? Were you small as a girl? What I want most is to have been a girl with you and played on the opposite team so I could have liked you and competed against you at the same time. Asking About You by Louise Klein Healy. I'm Stephanie Glazier, and this public poetry announcement is brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stevens T. Mason is a familiar name for anyone who knows their Michigan history. Mason, the state's so-called boy governor, squeezed a lot into his 32 years. At the age of only 19, Mason became the secretary of the Michigan Territory. That was in 1831, Just 3 years later, he became its governor and led the process of Michigan becoming a state. Don Faber is the author of The Boy Governor, Stevens T. Mason and the Birth of Michigan Politics, and he joins us now to talk about Stevens T. Mason. Hello, Don Faber.
Good morning to you.
It's hard to imagine the Western territories politicized way back in 1830 or so. It's easy to visualize just a wilderness out here that kind of resists politicization, at least in the way that we think of it in 2013. Can you describe for us the general setting of the Michigan Territory for us as it existed back then?
Well, political parties were just beginning to be formed the way we know them today. The Whigs were a loose collection of individuals who were opposed to President Jackson. And the Democratic Party under President Jackson was just beginning to form in the way that we know parties today. And then, of course, the Republican Party would come on the scene just a few years later. But that really could be called the birth of Michigan politics at that time in Frontier Detroit.
Did the politics of the region take shape around the discussion over statehood then?
It did to some extent. The Whigs, for the most part, were opposed to statehood because they thought that it would cost the people of Michigan more in terms of taxes, which it probably would have. But the Democrats, under Mason's leadership, were very strongly pro statehood. In fact, Mason did not even wait for congressional authorization. He just plunged on ahead. But he was that kind of a guy, very headstrong, somewhat impetuous, but he had a vision.
Tell us more about Stevens T. Mason. I think beyond the label of the boy governor, there's an awful lot that we don't, that many people living in Michigan just don't know about this guy. What made him tick? How does his personality emerge in your book?
Well, I think that he was a young man who had ideas for a new state. In that way, he became a young hero for a young state. But he came to us, to Michigan, from Virginia, by way of Kentucky, and he had this idea of making the territory into a state and fighting for the principles that he held dear, including strong ideas about education, higher education. And then, of course, he also went to war with Ohio over a strip of land that both the state of Ohio and the territory had contested. He knew he was in the right, Mason did, and he prosecuted the war, but in the end, Michigan lost out to Ohio, but got most of the Upper Peninsula in exchange. A lot of people know that story.
Is the political layout of the 1830s, does that end up having a lasting kind of legacy? I mean, are there actually vestiges of how the politics of Michigan took shape in the 1830s? Are there actually vestiges of that left around today?
Well, I think there are some to some extent. Jackson Democrats are still around in the sense that they share a view of the country that Jackson may have shared, which was that of individualistic opening up of the country, more freedom, separation from the elite East. And so I think there are still some vestiges of that kind of Jacksonian democracy in Michigan today.
We're talking with Don Faber, who is the author of The Boy Governor, Stevens T. Mason and the Birth of Michigan Politics. What were some of the bigger challenges that Mason faced?
Well, he first of all faced the financial panic of 1837, which was the nation's first great financial depression. Mason had outlined an expensive series of improvements to Michigan's interior, including canals and railroads. Well, when the financial depression hit, Michigan did not have the money to pay the men to build the canals and the railroads, and so these projects failed for the most part until some years later. But Mason's timing was terrible that way, and he got almost all of the blame for Michigan going broke during the financial depression of 1837.
We have a vigorous discussion going on in the state today about infrastructure. I can't get over the similarities to 1837 in a way, the funding for infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. That's amazing. How did Mason approach the Native American tribes of Michigan?
Well, he took the attitude of President Jackson, which was that they should probably be removed. And in that sense, it wasn't the most enlightened policy at all. In fact, Jackson was responsible for many unfortunate experiences involving the Native Americans. Mason supported the president in that regard, but I think only half-heartedly. From my research, I've found out that he really wanted a more humane treatment of the Indians at that time, but nobody was coming up with any solutions.
He ended up being accused of bribery was implicated in other scandals as well. He eventually moved to New York in some disgrace after his term as governor, but I guess there's some dispute as to whether he actually did anything wrong. What light can you shed on that?
Well, he had been sent east by the legislature to work out a loan to help Michigan through its financial crisis. Well, he negotiated a loan to the best of his ability. He was not a financier. And when he came back to Detroit with the money, some of it was missing. Now, it ended up, all of it showed up later on. But in the meantime, Mason had been accused of defrauding the state. And he made up the money out of his own pocket to clear his name, but the damage had been done, and although nothing was proved against Mason, his opponents just leaped on him for that alleged act of bribery. You're absolutely right. He ended up disgraced and had to leave the state, and it was only years later that he was fully rehabilitated and recognized as the fine statesman that he was.
Don Faber is the author of The Boy Governor, Stevens T. Mason, and the Birth of Michigan Politics. Don, thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thank you very much.
Come all you Yankee farmers who'd like to change your lot, who've spunk enough to travel beyond your native spot and leave behind the village where Ma and Pa do stay. Come follow me and settle in Michigan, IA. What country ever growed up so great?
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Last Thursday, a group of activists, community leaders, and bloggers announced a new social media initiative called the Test Me Project. It takes place today, which is National HIV Testing Day. The Test Me Project calls for people across the country to get tested for HIV and then share their photos and experiences on Twitter, Facebook, and social media with the hashtag #TestMe. Here to talk about the Test Me campaign and how the virus is affecting our communities in Michigan is Matt Hulbert, Prevention Coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Welcome, Matt. Nice
Thank
to
you.
See you. To start, tell us a little bit more about the campaign. How did this get started, and how has the word spread across the country?
I'm not really sure how it originally got started. We actually, in our organization, Lansing Area AIDS Network, mm-hmm. We're not actually a part of the Test Me campaign. We're working with them, actually.
But you're promoting it.
We're promoting it, yes, okay. Definitely.
How have people responded locally to this idea?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. We haven't had any negativity.
Okay.
You know.
How does the testing process work?
How we do it at our agency is it's the rapid test. So you will come in, it's just a finger prick, a little drop of blood, and then you'll have your results within 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Center for Disease Control has estimated that over 1 million Americans are infected with HIV.
Correct.
And 20% of them are not aware that they're positive for the virus. How is it so many individuals don't know that? Do you know?
I think they're scared. A lot of people, if they don't know, they don't have to tell their partner. They don't have to tell, you know, their new sexual partner, old sexual partners.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fear and the stigma of HIV.
And early detection would appear to play a huge role in contending with a positive test.
Definitely. Yeah. Early detection is key. If we can get if we can detect it earlier, the treatment is much better.
Do you have a number in your head for the number of people in the greater Lansing area that you would like to see tested today as a result of the Test Me project? Is it hundreds?
I would definitely love to see hundreds of people test today, yes. Throughout the state, I know there are huge campaigns for National Test Day. We're doing one at the health department today. It starts at 10 o'clock to 4. In building 3, so we're
What's happening there exactly? Is that the Test Me?
It's not. It's not the actual Test Me. It's our own campaign we're doing.
Okay.
It is. We're basically information. We're gonna have games. Testing will be later in the afternoon at our office.
Okay.
Which is on Holmes Road.
Very good. It seems like both testing and treatment options for HIV and AIDS have grown by leaps and bounds, certainly over the years. For a person living with HIV or AIDS here in 2013, what's the general prognosis like?
Oh, it's good. People are not dying from HIV or AIDS anymore. People can live long, healthy lives if they take care of themselves.
Even with AIDS. Okay.
With medication. Medication is key in staying on your medication. I'm taking it regularly. And early detection. Those are all things you should do.
Another issue appears to be that since the virus is more under control, that there's a perception, there's kind of a reaction to that it isn't a big deal anymore.
Correct.
So some kind of false sense of security amongst the larger public takes shape, and that has a boomerang effect.
Correct, yes. It's not talked about like it was 10 years ago even. So if it's not, it's still around. It's not going anywhere. It hasn't gone anywhere. A lot of people, think of Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
And, you know, how he's doing so good and because he's got money. Well, in the state of Michigan, if someone who is positive, they don't have insurance, they will still get their medication.
Okay.
So it's not about the whole money thing. It's mainly if a person is taking their medications, taking care of themselves, they should live long, healthy lives.
For a while now, data has shown that Ingham County has the second highest HIV rate in the state, behind only Metro Detroit. This is especially worrisome, I think, when you take into account that population-wise, as of the 2010 census, Ingham County was only the ninth most populous county in Michigan. We make up 2% of the entire state population. Mm-hmm. Are there any explanations given for why the HIV rate is so high in Lansing? Ingham County, I should say.
You know, there's really been no explanations. My personal thought is because Lansing is so close to Detroit, Grand Rapids, larger cities than Lansing.
Okay.
Where the like Detroit, you know, we're an hour from Detroit. People, I think they were there in 3,000 people currently living with HIV in Wayne County.
Okay.
And then Oakland County, they're separate. There's like, I think, 2,500. So that's quite a few people. And being an hour away.
It's proximity.
It's proximity. We're an hour away from everywhere, basically.
How hard is it to break through people's misconceptions about the disease? Have you seen an impressive amount of awareness raising here, or do you still see some really significant challenges?
I think it's personally, I've seen baby steps. People are a little more aware. They're not so much back in the day, people thought you could get HIV from, you know, kissing, touching, spitting, whatever. I don't see that much now.
Baby steps. What isn't happening then?
Well, the education. I think we really there's lack of education in schools. Honestly, they're not being taught about HIV, or you know, the risks of HIV. We're unable to go into the schools and talk about it, and we're currently seeing a trend now with the younger generation, with the highest increase currently of HIV is 18 to 24 year olds.
Why are you unable to get into the schools to talk about it?
It was because of the abstinence only. Was it 8 years ago? It's really hard to get in to talk about sex
in the public schools, in high schools,
yep.
In middle schools.
Yep.
In Michigan, there's a pretty fair amount of concern with regards to different groups. For example, 58% of the HIV-positive residents of Michigan are African-American, mm-hmm. but African-Americans only account for 14% of the state's population. With regards to age, the 30 to 39-year-old age group has almost twice the HIV rate mm-hmm. as any other age group. Are outreach efforts heightened for these groups that appear to be more vulnerable?
Yes. In the state of Michigan, we're currently we're focused on the MSM, which is men who have sex with men, and the younger age group, so 18 to 24. That is what we're currently focused on. But then we also have, for our outreach efforts, we do basically bar outreach. So you'll get the whole gamut, you know, of age group.
What is bar outreach?
Well, we'll do at our agency, we'll do we'll go to the bars around the area and just, you know, pass out information about testing, about HIV, stuff like that.
Tell us a little bit more about what you do here in the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Lon's been around a long time, right?
28 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm the prevention coordinator, so I do the HIV testing, counseling. I will facilitate groups, do outreach in the community, and do special events with colleges and stuff.
The people you know who have AIDS or HIV now, they are generally living good lives?
The
yes. People you know?
People I know, yeah.
Have you lost many friends?
I currently have not lost any friends.
Okay. About that.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, this has been really enlightening. Thank you very much. Matt Hulbert is Prevention Coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Plymouth's Mark Oppitt is a vintage radio collector, restorer, and owner of the online company Radio Parts, a supplier of replacement components for other antique radio enthusiasts. Mark is also active in the Michigan Antique Radio Club. It's an organization dedicated to preserving the history and knowledge of radio, television, and related disciplines, with a special emphasis on contributions originating in the state of Michigan. Club members present the annual Vintage Electronics Expo this Saturday from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Lansing's Best Western Plus Hotel. They get up early. That's at 6820 South Cedar Street. Thousands of classic radios and other vintage audio and video equipment will be on sale to the public. Mark Oppitt is publicist for the event, and WKAR's Peter Wharf visited Mark's home in downtown Plymouth yesterday to see Mark's collection and to find out more about his fascination with old-time radios.
Definitely by the time I was 15, I was into old radios and electronics, but by the time I got into high school, I took electronics class the first year I was in high school, and within a couple months, I was already repairing antique radios.
Tell me about some of those early memories of radios that you saw, sort of the first things that turned you on, listening to them, seeing them, getting inside of them?
Oh, it was a lot of fun at first, of course, because it's all new discovery, you know. And you think of, at that time, I was thinking of the 1920s being ancient history because I was 16 years old. So, you know, I would see something and think, oh, my God, this is from, you know, many, many years ago. And it's just a lot of fun to look at them and discover things. There were a lot of brands I'd never heard of before, like Atwater Kent or Crosley or these names that had disappeared. And every time I found one, it was like, you know, opening, you know, King Tut's tomb. You know, it was just a lot of fun.
Well, Mark, we just met over the phone a couple of days ago, and you very kindly invited me to your home here in Plymouth. Mm-hmm. And when I walked in, I just muttered to myself, wow, mm-hmm. you have hundreds of old-time radios.
I wouldn't say hundreds, but I have a lot.
Dozens, scores, yeah, at least.
Yeah. I'm actually not one of the largest collectors in the club. There's people in the club that'll make me look like a piker.
Well, it's impressive. Can you show me a little bit of your collection and talk mm-hmm. about some of the radios, mm-hmm. the models, the years, and that sort of thing?
Well, radio collecting encompasses quite a wide range of things. It can be table radios, it can be consoles, and in both of those fields, well, in the table radios, there's quite a wide variety of materials that they were made from. As you can imagine, the cabinets range from the earliest plastic, which was called Bakelite. And that was invented in 1909. Radios basically came out in 1920, so the earliest radios had wood boxes with a Bakelite panel on the front and a flip-top lid so you could get at the tubes and everything, and they were battery-powered, and you would hook them up to either a set of headphones or a horn speaker. They were very primitive.
At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Talk to me about this group of Zenith radios mm-hmm. here on your shelf. Mm-hmm. These look like all the same model, but all different colors. Are these plastic or Bakelite?
They are some kind of a plastic from the 50s. That's a 1954 era model that you're looking at.
Zenith.
Yes. And those that was a time, as you know, in the 50s when colors exploded in the home. Right. And colors on cars started to become more vibrant. So it was an exciting time.
So you have a black, white, turquoise, maroon,
yes.
green,
yep.
red, and pink.
Salmon. You missed
salmon.
Salmon is the fun color there. You really don't see, you know, whenever you see a color like salmon, I think I got that one fairly early on. And when you see a color salmon in a radio line, you got to go, well, there's got to be a lot more than this, because they went through all the other stuff before they got to salmon, you know. So.
What's this up above the Zeniths? That's a different model. It says Sentinel, I think. Is that Bakelite?
No, that, well, antique dealers call it Bakelite. They call everything Bakelite. But radio collectors delineate between specific plastics. And that plastic is something that's very cherished by collectors called Catalin.
It has a sort of a creamy, almost a pearl-like look.
The color looks like a pumpkin color there. Yeah. And believe it or not, but that was originally ivory when it was made. Ah. It ages to that color.
Really?
Yes, yes. And here, I'll turn it over for you.
Yeah.
If you look on the bottom of these radios, you'll see that they're yellow.
Oh, yeah.
And that's even not the original color.
Sure.
So
the color changes with light and
it oxidizes.
These are some of the tabletops that we're looking at right now. Now, would these be considered tombstones?
Yeah, those are. Yeah, these tall wood radios are what we call tombstones. They're pretty much any radio that stands taller than it is wide. Is called a tombstone, if it has a flat top, or a somewhat flat top.
And what are these two beauties we're looking at here?
This one's a Crosley 10-tube, which is the top of the line for that year, so it's their deluxe model, fairly hard to find. And what's kind of neat about this one, I actually found this in one of the booths at one of the radio shows. I happened to be in Chicago, and it was all beat up, and somebody had taken the chassis out and turned it around. And so nobody really looked at what a great radio it was somehow. and it had been beat up so bad it had a hole in the face of the cabinet here. I had this cabinet restored. Can you see where the hole is? Or was?
I have no idea. No, I can't.
Right there. There was about a quarter inch by 1 inch size gash right in the face.
It just looks like a pattern in the wood or sort of a knot that basically matches the other side.
It's been blended in perfectly, and you'd never know it was there.
Beautiful.
And in fact, what there's kind of a secret with some cabinet finishers. You know what they use sometimes? Bondo, car putty. And if you get, I think there's a couple of different colors of it, but it will take stain, and it'll look just like wood. This one's very rare.
I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, this one's extremely rare in that, it has another feature that radio collectors love, which is the tuning eye, and this will light up green when the radio comes on.
Wait a minute, something's happening. Hump shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
It's got a beautiful dial and a beautiful grill, too, sort of a glockenspiel or... lyre look.
Like harp. Right. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And I don't have a whole lot of radios with a lot of fancy grill work, but they made, you know, a lot of stuff back then that was really outrageous.
It's very beautiful. Would you show me a few more of your more prized items?
Oh, here, let's actually turn one on. This is a Spartan. This was made in Jackson, Michigan.
Right.
And you'll notice the name is spelled Spartoon.
Yes.
And that's because it is the Sparks Worthington Company. So it's not Spartan out of, the team
MSU, right?
From MSU, right?
Here it comes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your support.
Groups opposed to same-sex marriage upset. Thomas Peters of the National Organization for Marriage.
When it comes to the issue of...
That's great.
Isn't that cool?
That's the Spartan, and this is a full-size console.
We call them consoles or floor models.
Floor model, right?
Right.
What other things are hardcore radio fans into that sort of the average person like me wouldn't be aware of but would be interested in knowing?
They do like colorful dials, so that's, and you know, like this one is backlit here.
Yes.
You can see it is in like orange and red and green and yellow. So those are, that's a sexy feature.
Very.
Any other extra cool trim stuff on a radio, like this curtain effect on the wood on the corner? That's kind of neat.
I'm speaking with Mark Oppett today in Plymouth, Michigan. He's involved with publicity for the Michigan Antique Radio Club. Mark, tell me about some of the other things that people will see at the event on Saturday besides old-time radios.
Our members and the people who come to the show bring a wide assortment of stuff. Besides radios, you'll see televisions, you'll see audio equipment of all kinds, maybe turntables, record players, just all kinds of things. I mean, anything to do with vintage electronics starting in 1920 going up till about 1980. We highly encourage the general public to bring in any items that they have to something that we have called Radio Rescue. And we never know what the public's going to bring in, but it's like the roadshow of radios. Okay, so they can bring in, and we have experts, and it's free for them to get an evaluation.
Have you done this sort of thing before?
Oh, yeah. We do it every year.
What are some of the things that have come in that have gotten your attention?
We have, just like Antiques Roadshow, we've had some amazing things walk in the door. And
what sorts of things?
Well, the last year we had probably the most amazing thing of all, which was one of the two Holy Grail radios of all time.
We were talking about this on the phone the other day, and this is one of the things that you just sort of live to see.
Exactly. There are two radios that have ever sold over $50,000 in good condition, and this is one of them. This radio was found in a barn north of Lansing by a woman who actually knew it was there because her father had bought it at an auction, and her mother was getting up in age, and she was going through her mother's things because her mother was going to be moving. So she goes out in the barn and knows the radio is there, but she knows nothing about it. And it had been put out there 10 years ago with a tarp over it. Well, unfortunately, the barn had a lot of gaps in it, and the tarp had blown off, and the thing had gotten very weathered. Still, she looks at this thing, takes a picture of it, goes online, tries to figure out what it is. And her jaw drops when she sees that this radio she has appears to be matching something that she sees online that sold for over $50,000.
This was the Spartan Nocturne.
Yes, the Spartan Nocturne, exactly. Mm. It's a famous radio in radio collecting. It stands about 3 feet high. It's a blue mirror that's about 3 foot diameter. The radio is in a wood box behind the blue mirror, and the knobs and shafts and things come out through the mirror. And on the face you see chrome strips. And it is Art Deco to the max.
Think of a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers dance scene. This would be the radio.
In a grand ballroom.
Yeah.
In a hotel.
Right.
In Miami. Okay? Perfect. That's the as far as you can go for Art Deco. Let me show you a picture of it. I've got one here. This is the exact radio as it was presented at our auction. You can see on the face the chrome is all rusted.
Yeah.
But it's all there.
Oh, that's the actual radio.
That's the actual radio. Here's a picture of one of our club members hauling it with a hand truck. And this was brought to our auction last year. She called us in advance, luckily, and told us that she had it. And our club members went out and got it, brought it into the show, and we had it listed in our auction listing, so it got good publicity. Collectors came from all over the country to bid on it. It sold for $34,000. Yes. Even missing a knob.
Mark Oppett is involved with the Michigan Antique Radio Club. Their expo takes place in Lansing this Saturday, starting at 7 a.m. Mark, thanks so much for the time and the tour.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
Thanks for joining us today here on Current State. Tomorrow, it's our month in review segment. Tim Skubick of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, Emily Lawler of MERS, and Jonathan Osting of MLive join me to revisit Medicaid in Michigan, school district dissolution, the future of gay marriage in the state, and more. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.